This episode is brought to you in part by the American Homebrewers Association, who invites you to give the gift of membership this holiday season. Purchase a membership gift card with promo code GIFTIPA, that's G-I-F-T-I-P-A, all one word, and receive a free copy of Dick Cantwell's book, Brewing Eclectic IPA, Pushing the Boundaries of India Pale Ale. Visit homebrewersassociation.org today for details. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, December 12th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, I visit with Teresa McCullough, who's capturing and preserving the history of American craft beer at the Smithsonian. Teresa's been tasked with recording oral histories and collecting objects that will tell the story of home brewing and the latest wave of commercial brewing as well. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other basic brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way very, very much. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. This past Friday, I posted our video episode to the public of my split batch of simple cider that was half bottled plain and the other half with cinnamon whiskey, and I think it turned out pretty good. This evening, as I record this, Steve and I are planning to get together to shoot a video episode on my dry-hopped 15-minute Saison. It's a take on an extract beer that I've brewed in the past. This time, I took a bunch of leftover hops, several different kinds, 107 grams in total, over 3 ounces, and I dry-hopped the beer post-fermentation with all of those hops in one bag. And the hops combined with the Imperial Rustic yeast in some pretty interesting and spicy ways. I'm hoping Steve will like it. And we've been accused of liking every beer we taste, but I can guarantee you that's not true. Some you don't see, you know, and we have had some video episodes where we did talk about experiments or recipes that didn't come out exactly like we had hoped. So that's how you learn. You mess up. And speaking of messing up, Steve and I are also planning to record our annual disaster show this evening, and thanks very much to everybody who sent in a story. We broke a record. This year we've received many more letters than we ever have. It's too much to read every one like we usually do, so I've chosen 20. There are some doozies, and there are also a bunch of worthy ones in the not-chosen pile, too. So, again, thanks to everybody for writing in. And thanks to Desiree at High Gravity and Casey at Imperial Organic Yeast for pledging to send prizes for those read on the show. And speaking of Imperial Organic Yeast, this past Monday, I brewed an Amarillo IPA with Imperial A07 Flagship. And Imperial says Flagship is commonly known as Chico. And I can tell you that with Chico, you won't be discouraged, especially if it's A07 Flagship from Imperial. I wonder if anybody will get that subtle ancient cultural reference. Maybe not so subtle. I brewed this beer Monday with a starting gravity of 1064, and I pitched Imperial A07 with no starter at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I checked on it right before bedtime. I went to bed about 10, and the airlock was bubbling. And the yeast was very happy already. And that's not a surprise, because Imperial has the highest pitch rate of any liquid yeast, 200 billion cells. And they're so confident of the quality of their yeast that Imperial has extended the shelf life of their yeast to 4 months. So my stir plate is dusty because I hardly use it anymore. Ask your local homebrew shop about Imperial. I'm sure you'll love it as much as I do. Imperial Organic Yeast. And thanks very much to Casey and everybody at Imperial for supporting the podcast. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Jason from Portland writes, I listened to the episode about the Spruce Porter brewed in Switzerland. I've had a couple of brews with spruce tips, and I was eagerly awaiting new growth on my spruce trees this spring, thinking I needed to wait for the young tips. But listening to the Spruce Porter episode, I thought it was worth braving. Jason says, I steeped some 4-inch cuttings in simmering water first to get a sense of how strong the flavor would be. My house smelled like Christmas. It was great, and the flavor was quite nice. The following day, I brewed a batch of porter, and I added a big handful of 4-inch tips stuffed into a muslin bag, and I threw them in for the last 20 minutes of the boil. Jason says, I pulled a little sample wort before the addition and set aside and pulled another sample after the boil was finished to taste the difference. The batch is fermenting now, but the added flavor in the wort was delicious. Not too strong, but definitely noticeable. It should make a great Christmas brew this year. Well, that sounds delicious. Thanks, Jason, for sending that in. We don't have any spruce trees around my yard, but I do have a big rosemary bush. And I made chicken and dumplings with, or dumplings, as we say around here, with fresh rosemary yesterday. And it always reminds me of a sort of sprucey character. And I made an IPA with rosemary a while back that was quite tasty. So I need to revisit that. That'd be fun, a fun thing to do. Maybe a spruce porter. Mmm. Hey, High Gravity is having a sale on money. Well, a sale on gift certificates, which are basically money, on highgravitybrew.com. For a limited time, you can get a High Gravity gift certificate for 10% off. If you go to highgravitybrew.com, you can see they have several gift certificate denominations from $5 all the way up to $1,000. So if you've been wanting to get into electric brewing, for example, with a Warthog system, if you don't want to wait for somebody else to give you a gift certificate, you can buy one for yourself and save 10%. Now, the discount will be applied at checkout. So just add the gift certificate of your preferred denomination to your cart, and you'll see the 10% savings. Now, this is only for a limited time. Check highgravitybrew.com for details. And you can not only use these for electric gear, but for everything else on the site, beer kits, ingredients, all the works. Take the pain out of propane. Now for 10% off gift certificates at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. Okay, I've been sort of following Teresa McCullough's work from afar for a while. She's got a great job traveling the country, visiting with brewers, and telling the story of American craft beer. Teresa McCullough, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, and thanks to Maureen Ogle for putting in a good word for me, to you, and, you know, sort of introducing us. But you are working with the National Museum of American History within the Smithsonian, and you are chronicling craft beer. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. Yes, it's an amazing opportunity, an incredibly fun job. My position started almost 3 years ago, and as you mentioned, I'm here at the Smithsonian at the National Museum of American History, and this project was funded by a generous gift from the Brewers Association, and it came about because the museum has done a really great job chronicling the histories of winemaking in America and American cuisine, but there was a strong sense that we needed to expand our collections related to brewing history, especially to try to document this recent explosion of home brewing and craft beer history. And so that's the idea behind my role here, and that's what I've been working on for the last 3 years almost.
Now, you're talking to a friendly audience here, but do people respond? Do they think that what you're doing is frivolous if they're not aware of the craft beer industry?
That's one immediate reaction. I mean, I think as I travel around, I find sometimes people are amazed and amused, but always intrigued and envious, and you know, all of those emotions. To me, as a historian, those are hooks. You know, I always say beer is just an incredibly wonderful, malleable tool to engage people in thinking about history, but in a really important way, because most Americans, beer figures into their life stories. You know, even if they don't drink beer themselves, you know, they probably had a dad or a mom or a brother who drinks beer, enjoyed beer, maybe makes beer at home. And, you know, I have not found anyone yet who cannot draw a connection between their own life story and beer. And so what that does is helps people see themselves and their families and their communities within the broader stretch of American history. And that's really what this whole museum is about.
It kind of gives context.
Definitely, yeah. Context and flexibility. And, you know, I say this a lot, but any theme or event or era that you want to talk about in American history, there is always beer is there and can offer some kind of insight. So if you want to think about immigration or technological change or gender roles or advertising culture, you know, all those things, beer is always there.
Now, we've talked to Maureen a couple of times or a few times on this show, and she goes all the way back to the 1800s, you know, and the German immigration and, you know, the influence of you know, that era. Your scope is a whole lot more recent.
Yes, it is. And that's been a really interesting and in some ways challenging, but mostly wonderful experience for me as a historian. You know, I am trained primarily as a 19th and 20th century historian. And, you know, the typical experience for a scholar is to go somewhere to an archive and they bring you these tidy little boxes with materials that have been prepared for you by previous generations of archivists and librarians and collectors. And then you page through them and, you know, kind of synthesize them and try to feel, you know, think about what they say. But one aspect of this position that really excited me and has proven to be wonderful is the idea that you are collecting the history as it's happening. You know, this is a very recent and contemporary phenomenon, these stories of homebrewing and craft beer. But so as you're thinking about the present, you are certainly trying to place everything in historical context. You know, how do all these stories grow out of the past? But you're also thinking of the future, of course. I mean, the whole work of building an archive is future-focused work. So, you know, I think all the time, what might scholars and the public and brewers of the future be interested in knowing about our current era of brewing history today?
Now, what's your history? Where do you come from and how did you get this job?
I took a bit of a winding path here. I have an undergraduate background in Romance languages. I worked for a few years for the Central Intelligence Agency out of college, which was interesting. You know, I worked in a cubicle, though. I wanted to do something a bit more creative. I had always been interested in food preparation and cooking, and so I started to work part-time in the evening for a restaurant, just doing simple line work in the kitchen here in the D.C. area, and another night a week for a pastry chef, another night a week for a food writer, just trying to think if I wanted to switch more to the realm of food and drink. And I found that I liked those industries. From after 3 years in the CIA, I then worked for Harvard University Dining Services for 3 years. I managed a food education program called the Food Literacy Project and oversaw the university's 2 farmers markets. I went to cooking school at night. I still wanted to study food and drink more academically. And so then I got my PhD at Harvard in American Studies, writing about the food and drink industry in New Orleans. And when I was finishing that degree, this job ad popped up. And so beyond my academic and professional experiences, though, I did grow up with a father who was a home brewer. My dad started home brewing in the early 1980s. And so I grew up with beer being brewed in our kitchen, and he had me and my sister help him cap bottles, you know, on bottling day, and which I just was overwhelmed by the aromas as a 7-year-old. You know, I think right now I would feel very differently, but at the time it was just kind of dad's annoying hobby. Now I have a lot of respect for it, of course. And so just, I think, coming from you know, having a family experience with a beer-loving dad from Milwaukee and his 7 siblings, you know, combined with my other experiences, it turned out to be a good fit.
Wow. Yeah, beer is food, and it's, you know, you've got your own personal history, you know, as a child, and then tying, you know, beer into food and sort of, I guess, that legitimized the whole prospect of this project that you're doing.
Well, yes, and I think but you know, beer has it's been so prevalent throughout American culture, it, you know, to the point that its ubiquity, I think, you know, has tipped it in certain senses into being considered, you know, stereotypically in every man's drink. And so, you know, for various reasons, perhaps wine has received a bit of a more connoisseurial air. I think beer is you know, underappreciated in that realm and is now getting that appreciation it deserves. So, you know, the much expanded collecting related to beer here at the Smithsonian is overdue and now being very appreciated and enjoyed by people within the museum and out of it.
It's become kind of a cliche in our culture that, you know, if something is put into the Smithsonian that elevates it, you know, to a new level of respect and legitimacy, you know, like Archie Bunker's chair is in the, you know, and Fred Rogers' sweater is in the Smithsonian. So you've been able to take artifacts of home brewing and of craft brewing, commercial craft brewing, and put those into, you know, the National Museum of American History. Where are they going, and what have you found? What artifacts have you been collecting?
Well, and what you describe, it is truly a very exciting part of working here, that there's this kind of magical transformation from object to artifact, and especially in the realm of homebrewing, where your equipment is, you know, some of it is perhaps not too expensive, not too fancy seeming, but as soon as it walks through the doors of these museums, it becomes an artifact, you know, something that the Smithsonian has pledged to preserve literally in perpetuity. And a really great example of that process and of some specific artifacts I've been able to collect. We all know Charlie Papazian, of course, the father of American homebrewing. He donated a wonderful set of some equipment that he was using until very recently out in Boulder, Colorado. And so his wooden spoon, which he calls his charismatic spoon, it's probably the best known artifact that has come in, you know, as part of my collecting. But he also donated to us his last original copy of his first homebrew recipe, which he typed up when he was still an undergrad at the University of Virginia in 1971. He called it Log Boom Brew. It's a 2-page typewritten recipe. And then also his a ginger ale bottle, 2 ginger ale bottles that he procured from a local supermarket in Charlottesville in 1970 to bottle his homebrew, a green plastic garbage pail, and then also his aluminum stepladder that he was using. And he, when I was talking to him before he donated these items, he was especially looking at the garbage pail and stepladder, and he said, "Do you want me to clean these for you?" And I said, "Well, actually, we love signs of wear and use here." And so I said, Don't clean them too much. And he said, "Well, I'll brush off the spider webs." And I said, "You can do that. That's fine. That's fine." But, you know, as soon as those things were shipped here, they now are being preserved and taken care of in our storage rooms here at the museum. And when he was able to come and visit the museum at some point during the past year, and, you know, to see his objects, he had to put on the, you know, the purple nitro gloves to hold these artifacts that, you know, should not be held, you know, with the oils on our hands now. And that was a pretty hilarious, but also, I think, touching situation that he found himself in.
I can't touch my spoon anymore.
Gloves. Yeah, it's an artifact now.
Well, I got the rare privilege and pleasure to interview Charlie at his home several years back, and he gave us a tour of his little homebrewing shed. And I probably saw that spoon in person, and it's just a spoon, you know. But now it's really important, and it, you know, it was important at the time. But your part of your job is sort of assigning value to these things that, you know, right now they're just ordinary things, but, you know, 100 years down the road, they'll be preserved.
Yes, that's right. And you're right. I think in acquiring particular kinds of objects at the museum, the idea is to, you know, they join a very large set of collections here. I mean, the museum has 3.5 million objects that we take care of and preserve. And so it's placing individual items in the greater context of this, you know, big material culture that tells the story of American history. So, so Charlie's spoon, it was a clear object to request to collect, because, you know, we understood that he had used it as a tool to teach generations of home brewers to brew so many batches himself. And so, you know, it's an object that literally shows its use. You can tell from the wear on the spoon that he is right-handed because of how the tip of the spoon is worn. You know, it's worn on one side but not the other. And so just the human marks that reflect its use over time, it's something that makes it such a wonderful candidate for our collections.
That's interesting. I was reading some articles that you sent me links to, and another one of the important artifacts is a vibrating football game.
Yes. This is a very recent acquisition, one that was really fun to collect from Sam Caligioni at Dogfish Head Craft Brewery. He, of course, began as a home brewer, and to the extent that when they opened their first brew pub in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, he started brewing with a home brew setup. He had a little Sabco 10-gallon brewing setup, and so he donated to us his original boil kettle from this set of equipment, which, you know, it's topped with a kitchen pot top. You know, it certainly shows the kind of thrifty and do-it-yourself ethos of many American homebrewers. But then also this vintage vibrating football machine, football game that he used to invent this technique of continual hopping. And so, you know, as he likes to tell the story of how he was watching a cooking show and watching a chef continuously sprinkle pepper into a pot of soup. And Sam thought, well, you know, why couldn't I do that with hops with my beer? Sprinkle it, you know, dose it continuously rather than in one go or a couple. And so he went out to a thrift store and bought this vibrating football game and rigged it up over his boil kettle and used the vibrations to, you know, gently but continuously shake his pelletized hops into his beer. And so so we have these two pieces of equipment here, and you know, it's just awesome to be able to display that kind of object on the same table as, you know, a piece of brewing equipment from the late 19th century that we, you know, already had in our collections here, to kind of show this continuum of creativity and growth.
And it looked like from the photograph that there was still hop residue on the game.
That possibly, I mean, there's wear on the top of the game. And I did ask him, you know, is this from your brewing? And he wasn't quite sure if it was from brewing or just from being an already vintage piece of, you know, equipment. But it's again, well-loved and well-used, and that's what we like to see.
Yeah, there's something about, I mean, you can read histories, you know, but there's something about being in the same space as an object that really connects you to the history. You know, like, for instance, we went to the Museum of Flight in Seattle recently, and we're in the same room as, you know, the Apollo 11 command module and you know, one of Buzz Aldrin's gloves and his face shield, you know, that were actually on the moon. And, you know, it was an emotional experience for me. And I can't describe why, you know, but the fact that you do get to see these things, it really does connect people to the story.
Yes, I agree. And that's, you know, this maybe is a bit of a tangent, but while I've been doing all this collecting for the last semester, I've been teaching a course at George Washington University for their museum studies program. And my class has been, it's called Museum History and Theory. And some of the readings that we've been doing have focused on this long, just the very special and kind of hard to describe quality of having a physical object in front of you in a museum. I mean, just for a very long time in our history, it's been special to be able to see a physical thing that has been, you know, handled by someone special or important or been in a particular place at a particular moment. And, you know, that's just, it's just a kind of memorable and special quality that sets museums apart from other different, you know, from other kinds of institutions. And so in this building, you know, yes, we have Charlie Spoon, we have the ruby slippers from the Wizard of Oz, we have the top hat that Abraham Lincoln was wearing in the evening he was assassinated. We have the, you know, the original Star Spangled Banner. And so it's just this range of national treasures, you know, some of which are known to all of us from their time in the cultural and political spotlight. And some of them are, you know, treasures because we use them every day in our lives.
And beyond the things, which are important, maybe more important, you're collecting oral histories. You're actually going to places across the country and talking to these explorers or these pioneers and getting the story straight from the source.
Yes, and it's just, I mean, that's probably been the most gratifying thing that I've done in my work so far, is to travel around the country and to meet with professional brewers and home brewers and an artisan maltstress in Wellington, Colorado, and just all the range of people who compose the brewing industry today. And so I've been recording oral histories with all of these people, and they will be preserved. You know, it's a kind of archive of voices here at the Smithsonian, and accessible to anyone who is interested. But you know, several very interesting home brewers have been a part of that project so far, including Annie Johnson, who's currently the brewmaster in residence at Pico Brew. She won the Home Brewer of the Year award in 2013 and was also the first African-American brewer to win that award. Tony Amendola, who runs a homebrew supply shop in Richmond, Virginia. The list goes on, especially among craft professional brewers who began their careers as homebrewers.
And you got to come to Northwest Arkansas, my neck of the woods, to talk to Jack McAuliffe of New Albion.
Yeah, an incredibly special experience this past March. A colleague and I flew to Northwestern Arkansas. You live in a beautiful place, as I mentioned before, and it was really wonderful to be able to visit Jack in his home and to record with him and to, you know, hear his recollections of his career and, see some of the things that he's kept throughout the years. And I will say, as exciting since my visit to him, I've been able to kind of, keep chipping away at the New Albion story. And so just a couple weeks ago, I flew out to Seattle, Washington, and was able to record an interview with Susie Dennison, who, along with Jane Zimmerman, they helped Jack open New Albion Brewing Company in 1976. Susie and Jane, they supplied the capital, the funding necessary to open the brewery. And she recalled kind of with a chuckle that she had a van, and that was appealing to Jack when they met in Sonoma in 1975 or so, I believe. And her van was used to deliver their beer initially when, they were distributing their very small quantity of beer that they were producing. And so it's been interesting and really special to see how, one interview can lead to another, and hopefully the knit together, those will provide, a pretty complete history.
What are the forces that converged to make craft beer what it is today? I mean, it seems like it started out, with Jack and New Albion. Maureen calls New Albion the most important failed brewery in the history of the country or something like that. So it started in kind of fits and starts, but gained so much momentum to whereas today it's kind of, an explosion. You've talked to all these people, what are the forces that have come together over the past few decades to get us to where we are today?
Yeah, and that's the great big picture question. When microbreweries started to open, especially in the West and in Colorado and in New England, first in the mid 70s and then very slowly in the late 70s, early 80s, there was certainly a lot of interest, among the media, especially among those who were discerning in terms of what they liked to eat. And so, when I talked to Ken Grossman from Sierra Nevada, he remembered that their beer was initially successful because it was, well, in part because it was sold in health food stores, or, especially in Northern California, there was this curiosity and excitement about beer as part of a bigger movement in producing local foods and in understanding beer and wine and food as something that could be, produced at a small scale with locally made ingredients, and as a way that you could kind of signal your autonomy as a consumer to choose this beer rather than other imported beers. I think over the years it's attracted obviously an increasing amount of investment, and now we see bigger companies and investment firms interested in beer and brewing that, in a way that was never possible, in the early years of microbrewers.
Yeah, we're sort of entering into another phase. We had the growth period, and the sort of acceptance as of craft beer as a real thing, and small breweries getting big. Now we're seeing breweries buying up each other, like the Boston Beer Company has now bought Dogfish Head, as I understand it. And more recently, something that was even more surprising to me was New Belgium being purchased. So now we're kind of, you're a historian and you're not you're probably not interested in projecting the future. But we are entering into it feels like to me a different phase.
Yes, definitely. And this is always a question I have for brewers when I visit them, you know, what's the future of beer in America? And they throw it back to me and they say, well, you've talked to, you know, a lot of us, but what are we all saying at the same time? And certainly that is the great question. You know, I think a lot of brewers are just looking at their, the bottom line. They feel like the most profitable future for them is to focus on just a purely local consumer base, you know, not trying to package, you know, maybe opening up a couple tap rooms in a city or a region, seeing that as a more sustainable model going forward rather than trying to become a regional brewery. And certainly, you know, there's a clear sense that striving to be a national brewery is not realistic for the vast majority of breweries that are opening. And so in a way, it's a really fascinating turn back to almost a pre-prohibition model of very small breweries who are really embedded in communities and serving very local customer bases and with their tap rooms, creating these kind of, you know, community hubs where people can enjoy a kind of third space, a social space that is really unique within the community. But I think there's certainly unease or wariness might be a better term among brewers that I've met with. And, you know, I spoke with one person who said that, you know, if you brew really good beer and have a very smart, sustainable business model, those are the two necessary ingredients to kind of get you through whatever is happening and coming. If you're kind of lacking in one of those areas, then you might need to worry a bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. It seems like we are kind of come full circle, whereas, you know, the first craft brewers were like, you know, brew pubs and small organizations or small businesses. And then there was a growth period where everybody or a lot of people wanted to be as big as possible. But now, yeah, like you said, there are a lot of breweries opening in Northwest Arkansas that had no ambitions at all to even be regional. They just want to be a small shop and they just want to serve their local population.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing all over the country.
Wow. So you're talking to all these different people. Do you get several different conflicting versions of stories? It seems like the memory is malleable, you know. Do you get people telling stories about similar events and having them sound kind of different?
That's a good question. I think perhaps the best example of that, and it's not necessarily telling different stories, is my recent interviews with Jack and with Jack McAuliffe and Susie Dennison, and it's more a story of kind of putting multiple pieces together to offer a complete picture of, you know, a particular chapter, in this case, New Albion. But certainly, you know, oral history in any subject, not even just related to beer, you know, historians understand that oral history is a single subjective interpretation of something that happened in the past. And, you know, ideally you can use oral history as one very special kind of source, but put it in conjunction with other kinds of records, you know, whether it be newspaper reporting or, you know, even material traces, objects we have, that, you know, all of those things together should be the sources that together compose a historical understanding rather than just a single narrative that comes from an oral history.
Were you able to discover any surprising things through your research, some things that you didn't expect to hear?
Always. I mean, every interview is you know, a rich source of memory and emotion. Michael Lewis, who's a professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis, and he really built the brewing science program there beginning in the early 1960s. You know, and I recorded an interview with him in spring of 2017, just as he kind of traced in his memory the path of his career, and he recalled an early mentor that he had when he was still studying in England, and got a bit emotional just thinking about this wonderful teacher that he had decades ago, and clearly this person was not present in the interview except in Michael's memory, and just, you know, to sit across from someone and see them going through past moments and be moved by them, and explain how past people and places and experiences, you know, combined to make this person, to make Michael such an important teacher himself. I mean, that's just a wonderful thing to see. I mean, in terms of a kind of interesting, surprising fact, I hadn't seen this elsewhere, but Ken Grossman at Sierra Nevada, he shared that the first restaurant that put his pale ale on the menu was Alice Waters Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, which opened in 1971. And Ken said, you know, he didn't consider himself a kind of connoisseur of fine food, but was just aware that this innovative new restaurant had opened, was really trying to focus on locally made food and drink. And so he drove over with some of his pale ale, and the chef put it on the menu. So, you know, from there, it's, of course, got global reach now. You can order a Sierra Nevada in so many places, but it started first in Berkeley.
Where can people access your research, or where can people see what you've been collecting?
Sure. So if you are able to come to the museum, we welcome everyone, of course, to the museum. It's free. The objects that are in the collections here and on display, they belong to the American public. And so I'm very thrilled to say that after 2.5 years of planning, there are now brewing objects that are on display in an exhibit here at the museum. On the ground floor of the museum, we have an exhibit called Food Transforming the American Table. And Julia Child's kitchen is the crown jewel of this collection. The entire kitchen was collected from Cambridge, Massachusetts in 2001, brought down to the museum, reinstalled here. But then the larger exhibit behind it tells the story of technological and cultural changes in how Americans ate and drank from 1950 to the present. And so since I joined the museum, a corner of the exhibit, so just a fairly modest sized section, was given to me to curate, which was just a wonderful experience. And so that new section, which I've called Brewing a Revolution, tells the stories of early homebrewers and microbrewers, especially in California and Colorado in the 1960s through 1980s. So Charlie's Spoon, the travel journal that Jeff Liebisch kept when he biked around Belgium in 1988 and was inspired to co-found New Belgium Brewing Company with Kim Jordan in Colorado, that's on display. Some wonderful, colorful artifacts from Buffalo Bill's Brewery, which was one of the first brew pubs in the nation in Hayward, California, opened in 1983. They donated their original menu board and sidewalk sign, and also a lineup of tap handles, which we've installed in the order that you would have found them if you bellied up to the bar at Buffalo Bill's in, say, 1985. We've used a historic photograph to install the tap handles in the same order that you would have encountered them at the bar. Wow. Items from Michael Lewis, Fritz Maytag, Ken Grossman, those things, you can see them in person here. But we understand, of course, that it's not possible for most Americans to travel to D.C. And so if you go on our website, which is s.si.edu/brewhistory, that's the special URL that will lead you to my American Brewing History Initiative webpage. And you can see there just a bit more information about what I work on, including a fairly recently updated list of the oral histories I've recorded. You can always email me. I invite the public is always welcome to email curators to ask questions, to inquire about access to certain resources, you know, whether it's a link to one of the audio recordings, you're always welcome to request that. And then also on Twitter, I'm on Twitter and I document my travels and some of my collecting, and my handle is at Theresa Teresa McHugh, MCCU, Teresa, you know, part of my name, Teresa McHugh. That's where they can find me on Twitter. And then the last thing I'll say in terms of access to these things is, I do travel and give talks and host a variety of public programs and public events. Some of those are here at the museum. And one of those is coming up next Tuesday. And just for your homebrewing listeners out here, this is a special event that is near and dear to my heart because it really seeks to shine a light on area homebrewers in the D.C. region. We have outside the American History Museum, we have a beautiful Victory Garden that is run by Smithsonian Gardens horticulturalists, and they grow a variety of heritage fruits and vegetables and plants and other botanicals that are all significant to American history. Among those things is hops, and so the horticulturalists grow Cascade hops, Nugget hops. We harvested the hops in mid-September, and we divided the hops among two local homebrew clubs, and we said, please brew beers, with these hops that are grown on the property here. And so next week we are hosting the second, what I call the Hoppy Holidays Hoppy Hour, and these homebrew clubs will bring the beers back to the museum that they brewed with the museum hops, and in conjunction with a small batch of beer that's been brewed by a local craft brewery, Denizens Brewing Company. They brewed a Bock based on a historic recipe held in our archival collections here. Together, we'll enjoy those beers with representatives from local homebrew groups here in D.C. And also smaller breweries in the area. So events like that, you know, those are wonderful chances for us to welcome the brewing community and beer enthusiasts into the museum.
We love D.C. homebrewers here at Basic Brewing Radio. We've had representatives from that club on a few times, and they've sent us beers to, you know, experiments that they've done and such as that. So shout out to them.
And they're one of the two groups who have brewed for next Tuesday. So, D.C. homebrewers and Grist. Grist is based in Arlington, Virginia, right across the Potomac.
And your work goes on.
Yes, it does. Much again, thanks to the generosity of the Brewers Association. Their initial gift to the museum was for a 3-year position, and then after I got into the work, it was so obvious that one could spend a lifetime doing this, and so their members voted to give a gift that funds another 3 years for me to work here, and so through 2022, I'll be doing this work.
Wow! Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I hope to make it out there and get to see. You know, I've always wanted to go out to the Smithsonian, and now there's another reason to do so. So that's on my list.
Great, you are very welcome, and all your listeners are very welcome here.
Well, Teresa, I appreciate your taking time, and thank you for your work, and good luck.
Thank you, and thank you very much for all you do, and for all the great beer that your listeners brew.
Well, thanks again to Teresa, and thanks again to Maureen Ogle for the help. It'll be interesting to see and hear what Teresa collects in the next few years. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.